Breaking points, Jen. We're just going to take a quick look. We're not getting away from the broader stuff. This does worry me, though. The Professor Jiang predicts U.S. will lose Iran war from 8 days ago. This has 8 million views, which is well above what Breaking Points videos typically get. You know, stuff like this worries me quite a bit.
All right, guys, we've got yet another heavy hitter guest and first time guest on the show, Professor Zhang. He is the star of the popular YouTube channel Predictive History. He uses game theory to analyze past, current, and to predict future geopolitical events. And he joins us now.
Heavy hitter, like he's just a YouTube channel. You've had politicians on, haven't you?
Now, Professor, great to have you.
Good to see you, sir.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, for people who aren't familiar with your work, I wanted to show folks that back in 2024, you made three big predictions. One.
I'm not going to be like a super hater or whatever, so I'm not going to criticize everything that I hear. I'm just going to watch the video.
That Trump would win. Okay. Two, that he would start a war with Iran. And three, that the U.S. would lose that war. Let's take a listen to that.
In this class, this semester, I'm making three big predictions, right?
First, this guy predicts some better fucking cinematography for his videos. Jesus
Christ. November. Second is that the United States will go to war against Iran. And the third big prediction is that the United States will lose this war, which will forever change the global order.
So obviously that last one is the only one who has not yet come to fruition. Is quite a stunning prediction. You know, do you stand by it? And what have you seen so far that leads you to sort of stand firm in that conclusion?
So given my analysis of how the war is progressing, I think that Iran has many more advantages over the United States. The reality is that right now it's a war of attrition between the United States and Iran. And Iranians have been preparing 20 years for this conflict. In their eschatology, in their religion, this is a war against the great Satan. They've had many practice runs. Last June was a 12-day war when the Iranians were able to examine, analyze the strike capacities of both the Israelis and the Americans. And they've had a lot of time, 8 months, to prepare fully for this new attack. They, through the proxies, the Houthis, Hezbollah.
Oh, that's right. I did see this one, which I thought was pretty interesting. Jiang claimed 20% of girls are on OnlyFans, of American white girls, which is a pretty crazy...
I'm not sure if this statistic is correct. You can tell me if this is correct or not, right? But apparently 20% of all American white girls in their 20s are on OnlyFans, something like that, right? I'm not sure if you've heard this, but just the idea that you have a percentage of American white girls in the 20s, all on OnlyFans. That's just incredible to think about, okay?
And he just, listen to what he just said. He just said, I don't know if this is true. Obviously fake statistic. So anyway, that's totally crazy that that's true.
And you know, like the people joke that that's what America wants to do. America wants to liberate Iranian women so that they can go on OnlyFans and enjoy American corruption and decadence, all right?
This guy's tailoring his speech to the audience, which I think is usually, I mean, depending on the speech, I think is a problem. The fuck is Nico doing here? Well, Jiang just wants like attention, right?
So the statistic says on Google that for women age 18 to 24, roughly 14% are active on OnlyFans. So that's 18.
This is just not, it's not true.
24. Right. Imagine it's probably 20% or maybe 30% if you go up to 35, 40 years old. And the percentage of these women that are white, it's about 70%. So and that's the narrative you're hearing from the Trump people. They're saying, oh, look, the libtards are getting owned, and they're posting images of Iranian girls stripping free of their niqab, their oppressive niqab. And they're now naked, which is so ridiculous because it's the conservative right saying the libtards are mad that women are on OnlyFans.
The framing here is that American military intervention in Iran is bad because doing so is, it's an effort to spread American degeneracy and the widespread, the promulgation of like pornography, which anti-Semites believe is a Jewish plot to make degenerate the white population.
So again, OnlyFans, I think, is the best indicator of a society in decline.
Like, look, like, is this is my politics and history guy? Really? OnlyFans is the best indicator of a society in decline? Is that language you typically hear from like big geopolitics nerds or from weird right-wing incel cult guys? You know? Come on.
Hamas and the Shia militias have been able to really grasp the American mentality, and now they have a pretty good strategy of how to weaken and ultimately destroy the American empire. So what the Iranians are doing is they're waging war against the entire global economy, and so they are striking the GCC countries. And not only are they striking GCC countries, American bases, but they're going after the critical energy infrastructure of these bases. They blocked off the Strait of Hormuz. And eventually, they will go after the water desalination plants, which is the lifeblood of these nations because they don't have fresh water supply. In fact, the water desalination plants provides 60% of the GCC's water supply. So if a drone, and these drones cost $50,000, if they wiped out a desalination plant in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and it's a city of 10 million people, right? They'd be out of water in.
This is basic shit. Yeah, no, I mean, well, everything. So in this video, everything he's saying so far is like extremely basic, obvious, like 101. Here's what a war with Iran might look like, you know?
2 weeks. In 2 weeks. And right now, the Iranians have de facto closed off the Strait of Hormuz. And the GCC gets 90% of its food from the Strait of Hormuz. So I know a lot of people are talking about the disruptions to the global economy, threatening the very existence of Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, Qatar. And why this is important is that the Gulf states are really the linchpin of the American economy. So what they do is they sell petrodollars and then they recycle the petrodollars back into the American economy through the investments in the stock market. And right now, we know that the entire American economy is propped up by AI investments in data centers. And a lot of that comes from the Gulf states. So if the Gulf states are no longer able to sell oil and they're no longer able to finance this AI bubble in the United States, then this AI bubble will burst. And with it, will burst as well as the entire American economy, which is really a financial Ponzi scheme.
Right.
So that's a dire situation that the Americans are
Why
facing.
don't I get hailed as like a historical predictive savant genius for saying stuff like this, man? This is fucked up. I was making way more edge case calls.
Right now.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, sir, an Amazon data center was literally hit in
Too
the
white?
UAE. And
Yeah.
now, of course, big tech companies, which were looking at the UAE as a major potential data center investment hub with cheap and abundant energy,
You're
probably.
too left because you don't try to sound like an academic and also you're gay. I think stuff like this is meant to appeal to people who are very, very credulous, right? Like they want knowledge about the world and they want to feel like they understand what's going on, but they're very susceptible to narrative and they're very susceptible to having their egos flattered. So you get like oh, this guy's a professor. Look at his videos. They're so bare bones. He's not a YouTuber. He's a professor and he's sharing all this information about, I don't know, international Jewry with me. But then you see he goes on Sneeko and he talks about how OnlyFans is the decline of Western civilization. It's like, okay, what are we talking about here? You know?
Going to be rethinking that. We also wanted to talk to you about munitions. We can put this next one up here on the screen. The United States is racing to accomplish Iran mission before munitions run out. This is specifically around interceptor math. There's a famous video just from yesterday in Israel, which shows a single Iranian ballistic missile, which is being targeted by some 11 different interceptors, all of which miss. Most of
Is he really not even a real professor? Because that's also a big like red flag for being a crank. If you want to adopt the perceived legitimacy of legacy academia, of being a professor, of being a teacher, but you don't actively teach? Does he actually not? He's a high school teacher? No one calls their high school teacher professor. I mean, I don't know, maybe the Chinese do.
Was come from the United States, not to mention all of the different bases, the GCC countries that you just talked about, and the asymmetry of the cost. It's $1 million for a missile, tens of millions per interceptor in some of these cases. With these munitions running out, how does that change the global picture? So you're in China, obviously. Much of the stocks in Asia of the United States are likely to have to be cannibalized if this were to go on. How is that going to affect the global picture here?
Right. So my first point is that the United States military is not designed to fight a 21st century war. Remember that the military-industrial complex came into being after World War II and was designed to fight the Cold War. And the Cold War was really about muscle flexing, about who was able to send people up into space, who was the first to get the person on the moon, who had the more complex missile systems. And so the entire American military strategy revolves around very sophisticated technology that costs a lot of money to build. And that's what the American air defense system is basically. And that's why we're seeing this asymmetry, as you point out.
I think this is a massive oversimplification, to be honest.
In this war, where you have these $1 million missiles trying to take out these $50,000 drones, and it's not sustainable in the long term. And so what we're seeing is
he's kind of right, but I get the feeling this is one of those guys who never uses the term capitalism. So I don't know if he would make these points. Like he pointed out that the U.S. stock market is a Ponzi scheme, which is true. I doubt he believes that all stock markets are a Ponzi scheme, or that all financial investment in their nature turn into one eventually. But like the real reason the American military industrial complex fell apart is because after the Cold War ended, there wasn't really an enemy to fight. So the best way to fleece money out of the government, parentheses, the taxpayer, is for military procurement companies, Lockheed or whatever, you enter into really, really, really expensive speculative R&D contracts, right? It stops being about, we can produce 10,000 of this plane, of this tank. And it starts being about, well, no one can contest us. So we're not trying to meet any real military goals. We're not trying to achieve any like actual fucking outcomes. So, let's just, I don't know, fuck it, to the moon, right? Most expensive missile, most expensive plane. But this was just a way of keeping money flowing in the system, right? Otherwise, what would the U.S. spend its money on through like Pentagon contracts if it wasn't for the ever escalating threat of a potential future adversary? The war of the future against what country? I don't know.
The puncturing of the aura of invincibility and invability that sustained American hegemony for the past 20 years, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And this is really a reordering of not just the global economy, because this signals the collapse of the petrodollar, and with it, the entire U.S. dollar-based reserve currency system, but also the global hegemony of the United States. We're moving towards a multipolar world.
Professor, this morning—
He does use the term capitalism. He's critical of capitalism. I'd be really interested in learning what his criticisms of capitalism are.
Secretary of War Pete Hegseth was asked a question about potential ground troops in Iran. He refused to rule out that possibility. And he said, we're not going to project to you what we will or will not.
So far, I'm just trying to find out why this is an 8 million view video. Pardon me for coming across as jealous, envy as an ugly emotion. But, I'm just wondering like where this is coming from, because so far the analysis being provided here isn't really any different that you'd get from a basic CNN segment. Like it's pretty basic stuff. Like, yes, it would be an asymmetrical war. Yes, Iran could target local oil, technological and water desalination facilities. Yes, the United States does not like readily produce large amounts of its own ammunition, meaning that it would have difficulty sustaining a long-term asymmetrical conflict in the current year. The global U.S. dollar hegemony is reinforced through the petrodollar, and the Saudis in particular sell a bunch of oil, then use those dollars to reinvest in our economy.
Do what we don't want to, rule anything out. We will do what it takes. Do you think that America will end up invading Iran from the ground, since it's already becoming relatively clear that
stuff like this makes me wonder, man? Remember, this professor is not suicidal. What are we talking about? Bro went scorched earth there at the end, calling out the Illuminati. Okay, well, I guess we'll watch the end.
They won't be able to accomplish the goal of regime change or even regime collapse using just air power alone.
Right. So everyone says that the worst calamity that could happen in the United States is if it were to send ground troops into Iran. At the same time, the United States are committed to regime change in Iran. We've never had a precedent in history where you were able to regime change from the air alone. You need ground troops. And so, unfortunately, what's going to happen over the next few months is that pressure will build on America to send ground troops, especially from the GCC countries and from Israel, which are being pounded right now by the Iranians. So remember that if the GCC countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, Bahrain, if they go, then the petrodollar goes with them. So the Americans need to protect these countries, and these countries are going to demand.
Well, these countries aren't going to go. There's not really any risk of Saudi Arabia, Israel, you know, UAE or whatever being destroyed by Iran. It's really just a matter of regional stability, but, you know.
That either the Americans bribe the Iranians to cease, and this is like $5 trillion in indemnity, okay? Mm-hmm. Or send ground troops to wipe out the Iranian threat once and for all. And I know that there's no political will for ground troops to be used against Iran among the American people. But remember that 78% of American people was against initial strikes against Iran in the first place.
Right. And one of the things that really comes into question, I think, with all of this, sir, when we're looking at the geopolitical picture and the sacrificing in much of this from the United States on behalf of Israel, is kind of a question as to who and what wanted this. We were actually curious for your view on a disputed report here from The Washington Post. We can put it up here.
I only heard of this professor recently. A friend shared a video he did explaining Christian beliefs. Explaining Christian beliefs? Okay. This guy has like a massive clip industrial complex around him. So what, he's a master at predicting the future, but also he's a religious? Well, like, what's the...
On the screen, F3, a push from the Saudis, Israel, helped move Trump to attack Iran. Now, this has been internally disputed by Saudi Arabia, saying that they did not push the Trump administration to attack Iran. However, this is clearly an authorized leak from our own government trying to at least lay some of the blame on behalf of the GCC. What do you make of this analysis and of this narrative that Saudi Arabia was also trying to be behind this push to bomb Iran?
So I've always argued that both Saudi Arabia and Israel are heavily invested in regime change in Iran. Yeah. In fact, Saudi Arabia sees Iran as much more of an existential crisis than Israel. Because remember, Israel still has nuclear weapons, and Israel is a very diverse, very sophisticated economy, whereas Saudi Arabia is completely reliant on oil. And it's always had problems with Iran, because Iran is a theocracy opposed to the Saudi monarchy. Iran funds and equips the Houthis, which have been antagonistic towards Saudi Arabia for the longest time. And right now, the Saudi economy is suffering. It's been trying to pivot towards more of a tourist economy. That's why they brought in Ronaldo. That's why they're switching to e-gaming. That's why they're building something called a line. It says that they wanted peace, but they are helping the Israelis and the Americans attack Iran right now.
Actions.
Right. Okay. So this is the key question. Why do they do this? I think there are three possibilities. Okay. And I think all three possibilities are valid. The first is the idea of hubris. If you look at history, this is how empires behave. So the Mindoro kidnapping was quick, successful, and it was adrenaline rush for Trump. And that made him overconfident in the capacity of the American military. Mm-hmm. Okay? So hubris is a factor. And we see this throughout history. Why did Hitler invade Stalin? Because he conquered Europe really easily and he thought he was invincible, right? And that led to the destruction of the German army in
big oversimplification, but okay. I guess he's trying to like run through the points at the end here.
In the Soviet Union. So hubris is a factor. Then you have to look at internal political calculus.
Like he didn't take over Europe easily. Hitler didn't. He hadn't even begun to take over the United Kingdom. He knew, like, it's...
Where, even though America does not benefit from this war against Iran, Trump himself personally benefits. Why? Because the Saudis and Israelis are bribing him to attack Iran. Remember that the Saudis invested $2 billion in the private equity fund of Jared Kushner, who is the son-in-law of Donald Trump. And the Israelis, through Miriam Adelson, have been financing Trump's political career, right? So
this is true, yeah.
Miriam Adelson...
Like Trump and people around him are extremely financially compromised by Israel and by the Gulf states. That's absolutely true, yeah. Again, I'm just wondering why it's an 8 million view video. Like, genuinely, I guess... this all feels pretty boilerplate to me. Some of you guys in chat are saying like, oh, does he watch you? Which tells me you don't get your news from any other source. A lot of the stuff that I've been saying about this conflict is very, very basic. Like, a lot of the stuff I'm saying is not, I'm not an expert. It's just the 101 for understanding the conflict. Then you build analysis on top of that. But this isn't really analysis, right? This is just the basic info. Like, oh, the petrodollar reinvest in the U.S. economy. So it's literally that no one on CNN would ever say this. I disagree. People on CNN do say this. You can find segments on CNN, MSNBC, ABC, probably not CBS anymore, about the degree to which Trump and his family is financially compromised to the Gulf states or to Israel. You can find, you know, think pieces or articles or even video segments on from those news agencies on how we're not prepared to fight an asymmetrical war, how this hasn't worked before. This stuff isn't like, it's certainly not worth posting in the YouTube comments, this professor didn't kill himself, okay? I'm just saying, like, it's not.
A few months back said that you will put up $250 million if Trump were to run a third term. So Trump is getting a lot of financial and political support from the Saudis and Israelis. Also remember that if this war,
it has 8 million views because this is the first time a lot of these people will have heard in such a digestible form. I disagree. You know how I know that? Because this is Breaking Points. I guarantee you that he's repeating stuff that's been here before. There is nothing he's saying right now that Crystal and Sagar would not have said in the prior days. I guarantee you that every single thing he has said has been brought up by them. I think it's just a cult personality thing. I don't really know.
This war goes sideways and Trump is forced to use ground troops. He will probably get approval from Congress, and this will give him emergency war powers, which will allow him to influence the midterms.
Good luck with
that. So Trump is thinking about a third term. And I think at the ballot box, he probably won't get it. But if there's a war going on and you can delay elections and you have emergency war powers and people rally around the flag, then he probably...
The views don't lie, though. There are plenty of schizos, 10K views. Something about him is definitely appealing. Sure, but right, that's what I'm saying, because I think he's a crank. Like, that was what I said about Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson said really basic, banal stuff as a, like, superficial layer around an underlying core ideology that was fucking insane. Most people didn't engage with the core insanity. They only engaged with the superficial stuff. But he had this massive, like, clip farm complex. He was, like, the main character on the internet for what felt like forever. And the stuff that he said that people liked was really, really basic. Like, we all make fun of the clean your room thing now, but you got to understand that for multiple years of my time here on YouTube, there were millions of guys who thought the clean your room shtick was, like, novel and innovative. You know? They actually thought that. That was a real thing. It's not just a bit we made up after the fact. There were millions of people who were taken in by this crazy, drug-addicted, lunatic, you know, again, use the auspices of official academic credibility, Professor Jordan Peterson, right? Even though since then he's been incredibly disgraced in the academic community. They took his word as gospel.
We'll get a third term. And the last factor that is very important is the eschatological factor, where if you look at the Epstein files, it's clear that we are run by secret societies. It's clear that the world is run by these individuals who have a lot of power. We don't know who they are, but they control the military. They control.
We do know who they are. It's not secret. They're all public figures.
The national security apparatus. And these people, there are different names for these people. You can call them the Illuminati. And the Illuminati are composed of three major groups. Okay, you have the Jesuits who control the Vatican.
Okay, this is all completely insane stuff. This is all absolutely insane. I wish the Vatican had more fucking control over U.S. politics, man. It wouldn't be as bad as it was.
You have the Sabbatine Frankists, which control the modern state of Israel today. And you have the Freemasons, which control the national security apparatus of the United States. And they believe that Israel, this war in the Middle East, is key to the end times.
Notice how he ascribes this this end times prophecy to nefarious external secret societies rather than the extremely public and visible American evangelical community. Like, there are tens of millions of American evangelicals, their beliefs are public, their money isn't secret, It goes to their churches, their mega churches, their religious leaders. We see the politicians who use that rhetoric to get elected. All of them are public. You can find their names. You can find everything about them. It's not secret at all. The rhetoric they use is very, very public. If anything, I think that the Epstein files made it increasingly clear that there is no secret society, because everyone who we found in the Epstein files, we already basically knew about. We haven't found any Epstein files that allude to some extra secret person who was previously unknown to the public. It's all the obvious guys. Like, oh, did you know all these like super famous New York financiers and celebrities who were friends publicly beforehand were also friends privately on the island? Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people had known this for decades. We knew Trump and Epstein were friends 25 years, 35 years before the files came out. The files are just confirming the extent to which they're super fucking evil, which, like, yeah, okay. There's not like a secret society of people out there, unless you think that the files that are being hidden contain within them like an even more secret, you know. It's crazy the dissonance between him reeling you in with the pseudo-academic affect to say very, very basic stuff, and then you get to the Illuminati part. Yeah. That's the whole point. You reel people in with the... Oh, it is good advice. You're right. Yeah, you should clean your room. Cleaning your room is like an important part of being stable and functional. And then 10 minutes later, you're in the all men are lobsters stage of the lecture. Yeah. Saying secret societies as a way of shielding the publicly visible evil. I actually do consider this stuff to be kind of like a form of Epsteinite apologia, because if you're looking at the Epstein files and your takeaway from it is, oh, these guys aren't the ones doing it, it's actually some super secret extra layer. Like, what do you mean? So they're not responsible? Like, it's not them? I don't get it. Like, it's like, did Alex Jones not teach you guys this? Alex Jones went on for decades about secret societies controlling America. But by the time the Epstein files came out, he had been bought by the Trump administration. So now he just pretends they don't exist. Like, the people who allude to the Illuminati or the Freemasons are usually the ones who will clam up when the time is actually when it's time to actually, like, assign responsibility. Alex Jones was right. No, he wasn't, because because Alex Jones said it was the Illuminatis and the Freemasons and the Reptilians. It was actually his friend, Donald Trump. He was lying the whole time, and he knew it. Alex Jones was always closely connected with bunches of, like, right-wing financiers and propagandists, many of whom were connected to Epstein, like Bannon. He was always a psyop. He was lying to distract his gullible audience from the actual truth of the people who rule the world, which is that they're not secret. They're just the same rich assholes you see on TV.
In creating heaven on earth. So it's almost like a script that they're following, even though it doesn't make any geopolitical sense. Okay, so I would say that these three are the best reasons why this is happening.
Wow. Well, sir, I hope you come back. This was very informative, I think, for both of us. We deeply appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is why I don't have people on who agree with me. This is how I would feel. You just have somebody on who just repeats your shit, and then the last second, right before they have to go, they say some insane shit, but I don't have time to counter it. Oh, man. People have a need to make things more complex than they actually are. Okay, but the idea that everything wrong with the world is because of the Illuminati is the most simple idea ever, and it's for literal, like, brain children. Like, if you think the Illuminati are why the world is the way it is, your brain is young enough to have been molested by Donald Trump on Little St. James. The reason things are bad is because there's an evil secret society. Wow, welcome to the plot of every fucking Pokemon series. Are you kidding me? It's not because of secret societies, dog. It's a really complex web of political and economic networks where there large groups of people mutually benefit from hierarchical systems. And as those hierarchical systems self-perpetuate and self-reinforce, the hierarchies get worse, because the only way to reinforce them is to continue the asymmetrical distribution of power that they were built on. I don't know. That went on for like a long time. I don't know if I want to go through all this other stuff, man. How capitalism enslaves you. Okay, can I do one?
All right. Now, what's amazing about Marx is that today we say he's wrong, right? Communism,
I don't say that,
happened in the Soviet Union, it happened in China, but it didn't happen in Europe and in the United States, where Marx said it would happen first, because Germany was more industrialized than Russia or China, okay? Does that make sense?
That's what we say. But if you think about it deeply, okay, Marx is right.
I'm always after saying this. I'm always saying this. Why don't I have a billion subs? What the fuck? Is that all it takes?
Every society, every industrial society, to some extent, adopted the ideals of communism.
Okay.
It doesn't make sense. Okay. We call this socialism and not communism, okay. But basically it adhered to the thinking of Marx, which is to make the worker the heart and center of your society. And why did they do that after World War II? Exactly, okay? Because workers create value.
This is not... Workers were already the heart of society. They already made up the productive base. Marx predicted that industrialized countries would be the first ones to turn to communism, and he ended up being wrong in the sense that Russia was still, feudal, essentially feudal, when it flipped over. And we all saw how that went. Though I would argue that to an extent, the fact that in most societies, the most communistic demographic is the young college-educated professional, in many cases kind of validates the underlying theory, which was that the communist belief stems from a certain degree of material development. You could say sort of intellectual development, right? It's not something that emerges naturally from the peasant classes, which is why, of course, farmers today are the most reactionary class. Huh? He's teaching a high school class here. I think it's a prop. I would not be surprised if it was a prop. Like, he has some people whose job are to sit there and, like, pretend, like, fake a classroom environment.
Money doesn't create any value. Money just creates more money. It's speculative.
What?
But the workers create value. They're productive. And therefore, you have to treat your workers properly. So in America and in Europe, workers became the heart and center of your society.
This doesn't really make any sense. In my opinion, this isn't really a development of anything that Karl Marx wrote. Post-industrialized society required more educated workers. Now that you know, like, it used to be that 99% of your working class, the labor, the peasantry, they were just farmers. You didn't have to interact with them. All they had to do was meet their grain, their grain production requirements. And if they couldn't do that, you would, like, fuck their daughter or something, right? But when you move everyone into the city to work in factories, because you're not building factories out in fucking shit-ass nowhere, you're building them in cities because they're extremely expensive and developed and so on. You need people to be tightly coordinated. You need them to work together. You need them to have basic literacy. You need stenographers. You need accountants. You need people who can read, who can write. You get the idea of, like, mass public education. And in this environment, people start to demand better working conditions. It's not necessarily that Karl Marx made workers the center of society. It's that Karl Marx predicted and identified the features of post-industrial society that would lead to more autonomy for the workers. It wasn't really anything Karl Marx did. He just wrote about what was happening. That's historical materialism, right? If the world requires workers to be more coordinated, more educated, and live closer and closer to the centers of power, right? Now they're in the cities. They're not out there in the countryside away from the castles. You develop a society where their needs become more prioritized.
And the workers through unions could demand political reforms. And so our society was geared towards making the lives of the middle class, the working class, better, okay? That's why you had excellent health care.
A true Marxist would never say middle class, but, you know, even I do sometimes.
Great public schools, cheap universities. Okay, so the 50s and 60s and 70s was basically the peak of society for the working class. But in the 80s, we start to change this. Why? Why would we want to change the system? It's a great system, right? Marx is right. Having the worker as the heart and center of your society.
This just doesn't make the idea that the reason the post industrial era was good for workers is because we made workers the center of society is just meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. He's going to correctly identify that, like, Reaganism or financialization or whatever led to a decrease in the increase of the decrease in our respective care and standards for the working class. And that's true. But, like, the idea that this was a consequence of people caring more about workers is ahistorical. It's his third language. Cut him some slack. I'm just responding to what he's saying.
Central organizing unit of society makes a lot more sense than having money as the heart and center, okay? But starting in the 80s...
There's no such thing as having money as the heart and center of your society versus the workers. Those are different things. There's no such thing as the heart and center of a society. That's not a real thing. That's not like an actual category or point of relation.
We start to go back to money. Why?
Back to money. Is he making the argument that society centered money in the feudal era? He's saying we went back to money. So in the pre-industrial era, when the aristocracy ruled everything, that was when we valued money above everything? That doesn't make any sense. That would have been pre-capitalistic, or at least like in the early days of capitalism. In a mercantile sense, we didn't value the money more than everything. That just doesn't make any sense.
Excuse me?
I assume he referenced the Gilded Age, but the Gilded Age was the emergence of the features that allowed workers to demand higher standards of living in the future. The Gilded Age was when the contradictions were mounting. In a dialectical sense, you have two antagonistic forces. The economic need for workers to be more educated, more consolidated, for cities to be denser. And then on the other hand, you have the relentless profit grinding of the robber barons. You have like a tension. They want everything from the working class, but the working class's autonomy is becoming more important. And the resolution of that antagonism in the form of like union laborers and strikes and, you know, mass labor action was we got better working rights, you know, dialectics.
Who wants more? Yes, exactly. Okay. So what happened in the 80s?
Bosch is genuinely upset. He said money was the center of society during the Gilded Age lull. No, you're not understanding. Listen, there's no such thing. For one, there's no such thing as money being the center of society, like in one era over another, because money is just an abstract unit of currency the government distributes in order to facilitate commerce. It's meant to facilitate an underlying thing. The commerce or the speculative investment is the actual drive here. The money itself is just an integer. It's just a unit that you use to facilitate it. It doesn't make any sense on its own. It would be like saying that a society, like, I don't even know what like an appropriate comparison would be. It would be like saying that a society that's really like values volleyball, they center the volleyball itself as the center of society, not the game. But like the ball, the actual round thing. And it's like, well, no, the ball is important, but it's the process of it going back and forth that allows the game to happen. The game is the thing we're driving for here, right? Now, if he were to make the argument that economic development was the center of society up until the post-industrial age, that would be retarded, right? Like, he would essentially be arguing that the greatest era of American production from the 1910s up until the 1970s was one where we did not center economic development. Yeah, the fuck we did. That was like the main time we did. You know what I mean? Money itself is just a means to an end. What we're talking about is like the underlying policy priorities. You're being too autistic about every little detail. Ah! Dude, he's like this super viral guy. I'm just critiquing the thing that he's saying. I'm not being hyper autistic about every detail. It's weird that he's saying we used to have money as the center of society, but then Karl Marx had it that the worker was the center of society. That doesn't make any sense. That just doesn't make any sense at all. It might make sense if you do a lot of work interpreting what he's saying, but this is what I'm critiquing. Like, this is the whole thing. And this is what these cranks always do, by the way. This fill-in-the-blanks bullshit pseudo-analysis so that you're responsible for doing the work. But if anyone critiques it, they get to say, well, you just don't know. You're being uncharitable. You haven't read all his works. I had to deal with this with Jordan Peterson, too. Every time you critique Jordan Peterson, they would say, well, his weird, incoherent metaphor meant something different than what you interpreted. Well, have you read all his books? No, and I'm not going to, okay? I'm just critiquing the dang video somebody linked, all right? I'm just saying it doesn't make any sense.
Called the revolt of the elite. Okay? In other words, the problem with having a society based on the worker is it becomes too egalitarian, too equal, right? But if you're like the elite, you don't want equality. You want difference. You want to have power and money in your hands. Does it make sense? So,
did they not in the 1940s and 1930s? Are we suggesting that for the window of time during which the worker was the center of society, the elite weren't prioritizing their own interests?
The revolt of the elite happened in the 80s, and this is what we call in the United States the Reagan Revolution, okay? The Reagan Revolution. The beginning of neoliberalism, free market capitalism. And in Britain, it was called...
Wait, I'm sorry.
The Reagan Revolution, okay? The Reagan Revolution. The beginning of neoliberalism, free market capitalism. And in...
The beginning of free market capitalism?
In Britain, it was called Thatcherism, okay? Margaret Thatcher. The Thatcher Revolution. And so now you need to transition away from the worker to something else, okay? Another ideology that allows the elite to amass power.
The elite were already amassing power throughout. It just doesn't... Again, this, like, this... This, the logical conclusion of this nonsensical segmentation of history into overly simplistic archetypes is that you're ignoring the underlying truth. This video was supposed to be about capitalism, but our country was capitalist the entire time. It was capitalist in 1800, 1850, 1900, 1950, 2000, and today, 2026. It was always capitalist. What we see as different shifts in financialization or worker rights are responses to a dialectical process within capitalism of people who want and people who oppose greater economic equality. And that itself is a simplification. But the idea that it was pro-worker until the 80s is just not true. The economic elite were in charge in the 1970s, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s. It's always been that way. Of course they are. They're called the economic elite. They're... Of course they are. That's the whole point. That's the dialectic. Was the Gilded Age similar to capitalism, but just more brutal? I don't know if you're baiting me, and I'm going to exhibit unimaginable self-control by not getting mad at you. The Gilded Age was capitalist. I don't know. I think the guy makes good points. They're reductive as hell, but they're a good exposure to left-wing ideas. This guy isn't making left-wing arguments. That's the thing you don't understand. Okay, I need you guys to understand. Nazis made anti-capitalist arguments. Not very good ones, but they did. You can't just agree with something. Like, what has he said so far that's left-wing, out of curiosity?
So, just to show you how radical this revolution was. In the 1970s, okay, 1970s, if you were a CEO, the head of a company, okay, you were making on average $1 million a year. That's pretty good, right? That's really good money. And that $1 million was more than 20 times the worker. Okay?
Okay.
And that's pretty reasonable.
Is it? I don't know if I agree with that, but okay.
Today, the average CEO in the United States makes $20 million a year. And that is 200 to 300 times more than the average worker in the company. Okay, does that make sense? So in the 80s, inequality started to explode, right? And so they're transitioning from the worker to a new organizing unit called the consumer.
What? Those aren't distinct classes of people at all. Those are overlapping. The consumer is just a person who participates in the economy. Everyone is a consumer. A consumer, that's a relational standpoint. Every single human is a consumer, unless they're somehow like totally off the grid. You're not.
Okay. So they needed to destroy the working class, the middle class. And the way they...
The working class is not the middle class. That's a very, very, very anti-Marx, anti-leftist perspective. The Marxian perspective would be that there's no such thing as a middle class. The middle class were always just a financially privileged, elevated segment of the working class, and that the distinction between the middle and working class was an anti-left psyop designed to make middle America think they were fundamentally different from and therefore immune to the plights of the working class.
Did it was by introducing a new concept called the consumer, okay? So in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the government promised you a good job. If you were...
No, they didn't. That was the Soviet Union that did that. The government never promised us a good job in the 50s. We didn't have that.
Member of our society, if you are a citizen, I promise you a good job that you would have for the rest of your life, okay? So in the 80s, the government said, I promise you that you have low prices.
No, our government didn't promise us jobs. We just had a robust economy, so people usually got them. And there was also more job security back then. But that wasn't a government promise. That was just a consequence of the material conditions of the time. And also, companies promised low prices back in the 50s, too. Companies have always promised low prices. What else would they do? Promise high prices? As a matter of fact, the Great Depression was severely worsened by Hoover's tariffs, which worsened the Great Depression because they increased the prices of the already extremely unaffordable domestic goods that people needed. Like, the idea that the government should implement policies to lower prices, that's always been a thing. Hell, that's even pre-capitalism. Even in feudal societies, kings and aristocrats, their competence was often evaluated on the extent to which they would be able to get cheap imports from other countries. Take a look at the relationship between like India and the United Kingdom, for example, right? Like, if you could bring in lots of cheap imports, that means that you're extracting wealth and resources from other countries, the mercantilist dream. You want to get as much silver and as much like, you know, silk into your country as possible. Everyone's always wanted low prices. Who would want high prices? How long are we going to spend debunking this guy's obvious lies? The problem with me doing news coverage for too long is then, like, I get to this point where people in chat, their perspective shifts, and then I watch a YouTuber I disagree with, and people are like, why are you watching a YouTuber you disagree with? That's stupid. We should watch more news. You have to... follow me with the... Listen, I'm just an ant on a leaf stuck to a twig that's grown from a log that's drifting down the river, all right? I don't know where I am or who I am. I'm just reacting to what's in front of me, okay? How am I doing? I don't know.
And a wide selection of goods. Okay, does that make sense? All right, so... this sounds like a subtle shift going from the worker to the consumer, okay? But what this meant was a...
Again, I just want to be clear, that doesn't mean anything. That's incoherent. That doesn't mean anything.
Revolution in society, a revolution in politics. So remember that an example of the worker has to have political consciousness in order to protect his or her rights, in order to organize and unify and push for favorable political reforms, okay? Mm-hmm. That's what the worker must do, okay? But now let's think about the mentality of the consumer. And to do this, let's do another thought experiment. And the thought experiment is this. Everyone in the school, about 500 people, I decide to give everyone $1 million. Okay? So everyone in the school...
Perhaps I did too much good faith extrapolation. No, no, no. You don't need to feel bad or whatever. I think this stuff is really, really interesting, okay? I think this guy's a crank, but the reasons why he's a crank aren't always easy to identify, right? A lot of people who liked Jordan Peterson at the time liked him because the only stuff they had seen from him was banal, relatively useful life advice. The point, like, that's why I want to talk about this now. You get into it and you learn more and you have to understand, right? Understanding how the world works isn't about simple theories or getting like quick play-by-plays. It's not about the facts that you know. It's about the method you use to analyze the evidence that you're provided and what you take from that.
Has exactly $1 million US dollars to spend. What happens now? Think about this. What happens now? Use your imagination.
There's an interview of this guy in Breaking Points, and it all seems above board until he brings up the Illuminati and Freemasons. I know, we saw that last segment. Look for this guy's lecture, The German Will of Power. He straight up denies evidence for the Holocaust. Them out. Yeah, I know, we saw that last segment too. Don't worry, guys, we saw that too. We just watched it.
What happens? What's the first thing you do? What's the first thing you do? I've given you $1 million. What do you do with it?
I'd buy clothes.
Well, the first thing you do is buy something, right?
Yeah, clothes.
What do you want to buy? $1 million is a lot of money. What do you want to buy, Nap?
Probably a house.
You buy a house, right? That's great. That's a great purchase. Then what do you do?
Convince my classmates to give
me money. Okay, first thing is Nap buys a house. Then what does he do?
To
me?
We get to the point.
Buy furniture. Then what does he do? There's something that he must do that's very important. What does he buy the house? What does he want to do?
I don't know. Just keep this bit going until the end of the video. Maybe. Don't answer.
He wants to take pictures and post on social media. Right?
What?
So everyone sees it on social media. Then... you see this, Nap has this huge house in Beijing with lots of fancy furniture. What do you do now? You also want to buy a house. But what kind of house?
Bigger.
A bigger house, right? And then what do you do?
Also post pictures.
You also post pictures, okay? Then how do other people feel? You think this is funny, okay? But this happens all the time.
He may have a point that consumerism has ended class solidarity, making proletarians unaware of their status because they only identify themselves through consumption. Yeah, but this is what I mean about charitability. He didn't say that. He said that America had an era where money was the heart of society, and then the worker became the heart of society, and now consumerism is the heart of society. Which is a different... which means nothing. Like, this is what I mean about filling in the blanks, right? The point of having vague, like, pseudo-analysis is that more left-wing people can fill in the blanks and, like, construct a narrative that they agree with, but right-wing people can do the same. Like, a right-wing person, because, you know, you're leaving a ton of gaps, could look at this and derive any number of conspiratorial... Like, he's not describing the dialectic or the process. He essentially said that America wasn't capitalist through the early 20th century, or that we stopped being capitalist or something, like the elites only really reared their heads in the 1980s, which just isn't true. Like, there's just a lot of stuff here that doesn't make sense. And he is, you know, a lot of people are watching these videos, so I think it's worthwhile to critique them, you know? I'm not going after some small bean little YouTuber who's making small mistakes or whatever. I think it's worth looking into this stuff.
So... very quickly, what happens in the school?
We all spend our money.
And you all spend your money, and you all go into debt, right? Because you're in competition with each other to buy the biggest thing. And $1 million is a lot of money, but it's not enough to buy everything, right?
What are we getting at, man?
So you go into debt, you borrow more money to buy more things. And then what happens?
What?
And then what happens? How do you guys feel about each other? Do you guys have lunch together?
Just say the conclusion, man.
Do you guys like to share homework together? You guys hate each other, right? At the end of the day, what will happen is you all go into debt and you all hate each other, right? So that's consumerism. This is what consumerism is.
I'm utterly lost. I have no idea what point he's trying to make.
Consumerism
is when you hate each other.
A competition in society for prestige, okay? To see who can pose.
Yeah, man, that just started in the 1980s, which is why the phrase keeping up with the Joneses famously emerged from the 1980s. That literally the phrase that describes the plight of trying to outspend your neighbors for more conspicuous consumption, that came from the air 30 years before when he said, oh, man.
The nicest social media pictures. This leads to the individualization or the optimization of you, okay? In other words, you are now unable.
This is another extremely good faith take, but he's describing alienation under capitalism. For one, no, he isn't. Class competition is not the same as alienation. For two, why is he saying it began in the 80s? It doesn't, no, come on. Don't, you don't have to devil's advocate this. It's just really bad analysis. This shouldn't be taught by anyone. Like, no teacher should be saying this, let alone uploading it to YouTube.
To act together. You don't want to organize.
Keeping Up with the Joneses came from a 1910s comic? Oh, I thought the ad that it was used in was from the 50s. Okay, it goes back even further. Well, even more point against what he said then. The idea that the 1980s was the beginning of consumerism, parentheses, you know, conspicuous consumption and proletarian competition.
You don't want to act in solidarity, okay? And ultimately, this means that you develop economic logic, okay? And what is economic logic? It's to see the world only through the lens of capital. Okay, does it make sense?
Capital? What? No, this makes no sense.
So when you see someone and you're like, okay, well, do I want to date this person? You don't ask, oh, is this person a nice person? You ask yourself, how much money does this person have?
But people used to do that more than they do now. People marry for love more now than they ever have. It used to be women would be sold off with a dowry or arranged marriages, or there were more considerations for the future health of both families. Now we marry more for love than ever before. This is the opposite of correct. He's not just wrong. He's saying the opposite of what's true.
Okay, do you understand? You use economic logic in order to understand the world and to
Developed in the 1980s, by the way.
Reason to analyze the world, okay? Now, let me ask you this question. Today, is this how China works? Is this how the world works? The answer is yes, okay?
No, people almost, like, overwhelmingly marry for love. Overwhelmingly, they marry for love. People have been making financial calls in their personal relationships for thousands of years. This is not how the world works at all. This is ridiculous. This is completely ridiculous. Economics existed before capitalism. Economics is it's a function of human society. Economics existed before language did.
Are you like this? Yes, you are like this, okay?
But he's Chinese, okay, give him a little slack. He's teaching in English, and his videos are being shown to Americans, and he's doing a tour with American content creators right now to showcase his perspective on the world. Also, being Chinese doesn't mean you get to be wrong. This isn't really a perspective thing. He's just wrong. I guarantee you that in China as well, people marry more for love now than they did in the past. He's a high school teacher with a bachelor's in English literature. He teaches Western philosophy. Oh, there you go. Then he should know better. He teaches at an extremely expensive and exclusive private high school in Beijing. Wonderful.
You've been brainwashed into thinking that this is the only way to behave and to think. You're in school. Why are you in school?
So you can get a good job.
Why? To make money. And so you can buy things, okay? You understand? That's how you all think. But there are different ways to think about school, right? You're like, I'm in school to learn, to open my mind, to have an imagination, to think critically about the world, right? And that was the way we thought about school when the workers were dominant. But now that consumers are dominant, all we think about is, how do I get a good job? How do I buy a bigger house?
Because this is, I really want to know what time period he thinks the workers were dominant in. What he's talking about is the relationship between the industrial, parentheses pragmatic, versus the philosophical arguments for public education. The problem is that public primary and secondary education has always been largely industrial. The goal of going to school has been thought of as to get a good job for a long time, basically since public education became a thing. The distinction is in higher education. It used to be only a small percentage of Americans could go to college. So the reasons for going to college were more widely varied. Nowadays, you need a bachelor's just to get basic jobs. So bachelor's degrees are also being folded into the industrial argument. But this has nothing to do with centering workers. Public education was industrial even during the height of like union organizing at the beginning of the century. This is Joe Rogan political analysis.
I posted on social media. Okay? So, if you think about this, what this really is the perfection of slavery.
Okay.
Okay. Does it make sense? What does this phrase mean, the perfection of slavery? Yeah, you become a slave of the money, but what?
Rogan analysis right here? Dude, it's like you're a slave because you think of money and you go to a school to work a job. It's like you're a slave, but you're like not even aware you're a slave.
We don't even realize it.
Yes, okay? You understand? If you're a slave, you rebel, right? But if you don't know you're a slave and you like this, you choose this, then you will never rebel, okay? So the consumerism is the perfection of slavery. Okay? And that's why Francis Fukuyama thinks that consumerism is the end of history.
Oh, that's a misreading of Fukuyama's writings. That's, he's written about this, man. Fukuyama still writes. Okay.
Because it is a system that achieves what the elites want, and the masses are unwilling and unable to protest and rebel. Okay, does that make sense? It's a perfect system.
Okay. This was not left-wing at all. I think that this trended a little bit more towards right-wing, but mostly it was just incoherent. Do you mind if a white boy learns a little bit about secret societies? Then I'll be done.
Okay.
Oh, shit.
So, women...
this one... You know this one's going to be spicy because he's doing it in a different environment. This one's not getting shown to the students. He didn't want the parents calling in afterwards.
Do is... First thing I'm going to do is explain to you what most Christians believe.
By normal high school standard, this shit is Marx. No, I disagree. I attended American high school, and I think that the education I got on our history was far better there. I even think the economic... Admittedly, I did go to AP history, AP US history, so maybe better there. But, like, by and large, no. This, I mean, a lot of what he just said is just flat wrong. It's just completely incorrect. So there's no...
about their religion, okay? This is called the orthodox or the canonical perspective. Okay, so this is what you're taught officially by the church. Christianity has many different factions, but they all believe in a certain interpretation of the Bible, okay? Then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna show you the apocryphal. Apocryphal. Apocryphal just means hidden, okay? Or secret, or esoteric. No. Just a secret knowledge that is kept within these secret societies. All right.
We just started with the crazy. I thought he was going to build up to it. I thought I was going to get like a breakdown of how there are secret societies.
So the Orthodox canonical comes from a reading of the Bible. And the Bible, at its core, is a story of the covenant between God and humans, okay? Covenant. Covenant means contract or understanding.
Not really. I mean, the Bible was writings from the apostles summarizing the events around. I mean, that's part of it. Is that like the main thing? Most of the Bible is about. I would argue that if we had to boil it down to the main point of the Bible, it's look at Christ's life and learn lessons from it. Not so much about the contract, right? It's like here's him being goaded with the sauce. You can take from these moral lessons on how you're meant to behave. I don't know if the contractual element's the main one, but
so
that's just the New Testament. I know, but that's what people mean colloquially when they say the Bible, right? I mean, does he mean the Old Testament too? Maybe he does. When I hear the Bible, I hear the New Testament, but I'm American, so I don't know.
So throughout the Bible, there are a series of covenants, okay? The first covenant is between Adam
Messiah,
and God.
Stop yelling at me.
So you may have heard of the story of the Garden of Eden, right? God creates the universe, then creates the Garden of Eden, where he puts Adam and Eve. And God says to Adam and Eve, this is paradise. You don't have to work. Just enjoy life. The food is free. The food is plentiful. Every day you'll be happy and free of want. You will live forever. But there's only one thing that you must not do. And only one thing, okay? Whatever you do, do not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Just don't do that and you'll be okay. So of course, what do Adam and Eve do? They eat the stupid fruit, okay?
No, it was literally the smart fruit, you fucking moron. You just said it. It was the smart fruit.
Then what God does is he banishes Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. And now they're forced to work to grow food to feed themselves, okay? And this leads to society, okay, development of society. God looks down from the heavens and sees that humans now are going to war. They are fighting. They have private property. And God says, I don't want this crap. This is not why I created humans. Okay? So he's like, you know what? I'm going to destroy everyone and start over. But then he sees a human that he likes.
We skipped a few steps, but okay. I'm wondering how this translates into the secret society bit.
Noah. And this leads to God saying to Noah, build a ship, build an ark, and save yourself, because I will flood the universe. I will destroy the world. So God destroys the world, and Noah lives. And then God says to Noah, you know what? That's kind of silly. I shouldn't destroy the universe. I promise never, ever destroy the world again.
Okay? It's actually
that
the plot of Evangelion.
With Noah. But God sees that humans are still wicked and evil. And he says, you know what? I need to find a man who is good. And I need him to grow a nation that can be the light of the world, that will be the best example of what it means to be a good person. So he finds a man named Abraham, and Abraham, of course, is the father of a nation called Israel.
And why do these guys always want to be a preacher instead of a teacher? I'm interested mostly because in my experience, when a person is making an argument about why a group of people are the way they are or why they act the way they do, as soon as they reference scripture, I instantly think they're full of shit. Because there is basically no relationship, no predictive ability you can get from the content of a person's religious text and what they actually do and believe. Like, you know, Christians are supposed to, you know, as I'm aware, right, take inspiration from the life of Jesus Christ, who was a chill guy. But a lot of Christians are fucking Hitlerite, you know? People say the Muslims, you know, they worship Muhammad and he had a child bride. Did he? Yeah, I guess so. But who clearly in the United States advances the agenda of the pedophiles? Christians and Jews. American Muslims right now are just like this, you know? The Zionazis, the fucking evangelicals and the Zionist Jews and so on. They're the ones being implicated. I don't see a lot of Muslims, a lot of Mohammeds being implicated in the damn Epstein files. So I don't know. I just don't think there's that much of a relationship between like the text and the behavior. I think that people mostly behave the way they do in accordance with the sort of material conditions they're born into and influenced by, and the environment they grow up in, and the text just legitimizes their behavior metaphysically if they choose to. But they'll ignore whatever they have to.
This is the third covenant. God says to Abraham, you and your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren are now loyal to me. I see you as the chosen people, and I give you the promised land. Okay, that's what Israel is, a promised land. Over time, what happens is that Abraham and his people, they go off to Egypt. And in Egypt, they become slaves to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And then God is like, you know what? I should check up on the Israelites and see how they're doing.
Dog, YouTube chat is full of people who are still upset we're watching this, as though the first 5 years of my channel was not 90% dedicated to me watching YouTube videos of people I don't like and making fun of them. You guys got to harden the fuck up. This is not a 24/7 news station. If you want that shit, you go to CNN 18 or whatever, okay? Go find one of those live channels. Holy shit. We're watching this because it gives me a platform to talk about stuff I find interesting. Quit fucking whining. You're so annoying. Oh my God. If you're not interested in the content, just leave, okay? Just leave. You can come back later. We've been doing, like, nonstop news for months, and you people are this upset at, like, a one-hour departure?
He looks down and he says, oops, they're now slaves to the Pharaoh. So I need to fix this, okay?
I'm always saying that.
So he appoints a man named Moses to free the Israelites from Egypt and take them back to the promised land. When Moses does this, God says, now what you must do is give the Israelites my law, the Ten Commandments, okay? The law. Because otherwise, I can't trust you guys to behave, okay? So now this is the fourth covenant. So now the Israelites are back in the promised land, but again, and even though there's laws, they still become wicked. And they start to worship false gods. So God punishes them. And God is now looking for a good leader of the Israelites. And then finally he finds a person named David.
We're skipping a lot of shit, man.
The king of the Israelites. And God says to David, you are the person I've been looking for all of eternity. You are the best example of what it means to be a faithful follower of me, Yahweh. Okay.
Like, we're skipping a lot of shit, but I'm not entirely sure what the point of this is, or like what we're getting to, how this has anything to do with secret societies.
And so this is something called the Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant states that God will always favor Israel as the chosen nation, and the house of David will rule Israel forever. Okay? So guys, quick question here. Who wrote the Bible?
Which
probably
part?
Probably this guy, okay?
Well,
right?
Wait,
if you had to guess who wrote the Bible, probably not Moses, probably not Abraham, probably not Noah, probably not Adam, probably this guy, okay? Because he's saying that all of these five...
It was written by a lot of people, man. Are we just talking... So when he says Bible, he just means the Old Testament? We're ignoring the New? We're ignoring Christ? Okay, well, there's still a lot of authors. Okay.
Okay? I am the best. I'm the person that God loves the most. My family will rule the world because that is God's will. Okay. Now, of course, that's not what happens. Eventually, David has a son named Solomon, and these two are considered the two best rulers of Israel. And this is what we call the Davidic kingdom, okay? The Davidic kingdom, the golden age of Israel. But after Solomon, the Israelites turn wicked again. And then God has to punish them and scatter Israel across the world.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And so the last covenant is the arrival of Jesus.
Okay. I've heard of this guy.
What Jesus does is that, first of all, he reasserts the law of Moses and say to the Israelite people, remember Moses and his law, because that's what God wants. And then he sacrifices himself in order to free the Israelites of the original sin.
What? I mean, everyone, but...
Right, because God's pissed off at people because people ate the fruit. That's the original sin.
The timeline's all fucked. This fucked up in a variety of ways. I'm sure that if I was like really educated on Christian theology, I could probably rant about this for 2 hours. It's not even like the important part.
That's the first crime of disobedience against God. So by killing himself, Jesus frees...
No, Moses only freed the Jews of sin. The Jews don't believe in original sin the way Christians do. Because the Jews don't even believe in Christ. Well, they believe in Christ. They don't think that Christ was the Son of God. So, also, did he just say Christ killed himself?
Disobedience against God. So by killing himself, Jesus...
Well, that's a way of summarizing it, I guess.
This frees humanity of the original sin. He redeems humanity. Okay? Now, last thing that Jesus does is he creates a new covenant.
Where he unalived himself. He committed sewer slide.
Okay? A new covenant between humanity and God. From now on, because Jesus has freed everyone from the original sin, everyone can now be with God. You don't have to be Israelite. You don't have to follow the Mosaic law. You don't even have to come from the family of David. Anyone and everyone can now love God, and God will love that person back, okay? And this, of course, starts Christianity. All right, so...
I really don't think... I mean, it's made up, so I don't want to get too into the weeds here. I just... I feel like there's a reason he's summarizing this the way that he is, so I guess I'll wait to see what he derives from this.
This, guys, is called Judaism, what the Jews believe. Okay? And this is all six is what Christians believe, Christianity.
I mean, like, not really, no. Kind of. It depends. Very, very broadly. But, like, Christians don't follow the Torah. It's, like, there's parts of it they believe in, but not all of it. I don't... It's all... It has what it is.
All right? The first five covenants are what Jews believe to be true. But they do believe that eventually someone will return to restore the kingdom of David. Okay? But not Jesus. Not Jesus. The Christians believe that Jesus is the final prophet. Okay? In fact, Jesus is God himself. That's why it's called Christianity. Because they believe in Jesus Christ. So this is...
Christian Zionists believe both. I just don't like... I don't like everything being summarized this way because, for one, like, no, it really depends on the Christians, okay? There's so much variety out there. It's all fake lore, and there's, like, 2 billion Christians, you know? Whether or not Christians believe the earth is 6,000 years old, that's like an American evangelical creationist thing. But there are massive distinctions in what different groups of Christians believe, and also it's all made up anyway, so fucking who cares? The point that I care about is the leading conclusion that he's trying to arrive at here, which I assume has something to do with, like, how Jews control the world. I don't know. We'll see.
Entire history of Judaism and Christianity, what they believe, officially. Any questions before I move on?
Like what is officially here? Like, that doesn't... Officially? It's very ahistorical to treat religious belief as some kind of, like, canonical, this is what it means to be X, when in reality, the history of what Christians believe is as fluid as, like, what language is. English was different 100 years ago. It was very different 500 years ago. You know, the idea, like, was there an English 500 years ago? Yeah, sure. Was there a Christianity 1,000 years ago? Yeah, but, like, it was very fucking different. And if you talked to Christians back then, asked them what they believed or how they felt about the world, it'd be very, very different, even if the foundational texts may be, to an extent, similar. So it's, you're treating theology as he treats history, by the way, as, like, a very boiled down, highly simplistic... Like, for me, I think it's anti-intellectual to front all of this information to begin with on like a chalkboard. I think it's anti-intellectual to even do that. Like, if you're just a random YouTuber trying to ballpark some facts before getting to a point, that's one thing. But the way he's presenting this makes it seem like, okay, so this is Christianity, this is Judaism. It's very complicated. I guess I wish he would at least say that. I wish he would say that. I wish he would say, this is a quick summary. It's much more complicated than making. Wouldn't that be responsible of him to say? Like, if I was trying to lay all this out, I'm not going to pretend I know enough about theology to like concretely lay out the entire, you know, texts of the New and Old Testament and everything about. But like, I would definitely say, I'm just kind of like getting to a point here. I'm just riffing. I'm just saying this. I'm just saying that. I'm trying to like get to a point. I don't like it when people don't do that.
Okay. But now, as you can understand, if you are a true Christian or you're a true Jew, there are actually lots of issues with this understanding. Okay? The first issue is, why did God have to kick us out of the Garden of Eden? I mean, was eating of fruit so bad?
That's what you mean by an issue? That's an issue? How it... I thought by issue he meant like disagreements on canon or in text.
As to banish us from paradise? Like, what was wrong reading that fruit? Okay, that's a great mystery in the religion. Why did the original sin happen? And why was God so angry?
Because they disobeyed him. I thought he was going to go into like the many, many, many ahistorical errors in the Bible or whatever. That
second problem is Noah. I mean, like, God destroyed the world because we were wicked, but after he destroyed the world, we were still wicked. So why did God have to destroy the world in the first place? If he's God, then should he understand how humans are? That wouldn't he understand that destroying the world would just, I mean, it doesn't really do anything, okay?
No. Because God gave man free will, and the whole point of living on Earth is that we're supposed to use our free will to make judgments about morality and about our decision-making and to choose to follow God or not. And by wiping us all out with the Great Flood, he was trying to reset things to a point where people might make better decisions, which clearly they didn't. But God's foreknowledge is not supposed to extend to, like, in a deterministic sense, who gets to go to heaven, unless you're a Calvinist, I guess.
So, that's kind of strange. The last problem is Jesus. Who was Jesus? And why did he have to kill himself? What did...
I'm sorry. I don't know, man. That was super fucked up of him. There had to be a better way. There had to be a better way.
God had to send his only son to die for humanity. Okay, so if you're new to Christianity, the very idea of Jesus actually doesn't make much sense to you. I grew up in the West.
I really don't think this is true. There are lots of things that lead Christians to self-doubt. A lot of like inconsistencies and ahistoricisms and like the behavior of the church. But like, why Christ would do that? I have never heard of a Christian. I'm sure there are some. But I think that's one of the, it's not just straightforward from the Christian doctrine, it's like the thing you're supposed to buy in on, that he died to save you from your sins. That is the thing you're supposed to buy in on, you know?
I grew up in a Christian world, and it never made sense to me, okay? People told me about how great Jesus was, like, okay, the story doesn't make any sense. So if you're a really smart person, there are lots of questions.
Okay, this is just insane. If you're really smart, you might notice some problems with my, like, 6-bullet-point summary of the New and Old Testament. You could probably find a few more in there if you wanted to. Why did all the first sons of Egypt have to suffer just because the Pharaoh was stubborn? I mean, you just roll them all out there, you know?
About this interpretation of the Bible, and these are the 3 major ones.
Okay.
So now what I will do now is I'll explain to you what the esoteric, what secret societies believe really happened. Okay? So, I want to start with Noah. Why did God destroy the world? The reason why God destroyed the world is not because of humans, but because of something else. These people are called the Nephilim.
I remember this from the Diablo lore.
Okay. Also, by the way, if you guys are interested in learning more, there are two books that are not part of the Bible, but which will give you insight into the esoteric knowledge, okay? The first is called the Book of Enoch. Book of Enoch.
Okay. I'm Googling.
The Gospel of Thomas.
All right.
Okay. All right. So I am using these two
books. Book of Enoch, an ancient Jewish apocalyptic religious text ascribed by tradition to the patriarch Enoch, who was father of Methuselah and the great-grandfather of Noah. Contains unique material on the origins of demon and Nephilim and why some angels fell from heaven. It's really interesting stuff. Gotcha. Not considered to be canonical scripture by most movements of Judaism or branches of Christianity, though it is a part of the biblical canon, used by the Ethiopian Jewish community, Beta Israel, as well as the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church and Eritrean Orthodox Tewahedo Church. Huh. Part of the reason why I say you can't just summarize Christian canon as like this is what they believe, dog, it's all fake. Like different groups of people believe different shit, and then all of them apply the belief hypocritically
as sources for my explanation. Okay, so the Nephilim are
the children of angels and demons, and they like power scale like fuck in the late game. I know, I remember.
Children of angels and woman. Okay, so what happened was that the angels who were supposed to watch humanity came down and saw, wow, these humans, these females are really beautiful. So what do? Well, they have sex with them.
Okay.
Right? And then what happens? They have lots and lots of children. Mm-hmm. And what do these children do?
So
these
real.
Children enslave humanity.
Oh.
These people are called Nephilim, okay? Mm-hmm. So if you want to understand what happened, let's do a thought experiment. Let's just say that there's this group of superhumans called the Avengers. You know, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, okay? And they fight Thanos, and they save the world. And now what do? Well, they're bored, so they start to have lots and lots
close
of sex.
Close enough. Welcome back,
lots
Spirit
and lots
Science.
Of children. And these children now are like demagogues, right? So what do? Well, they enslave humanity. But then what do? Well, they start fighting amongst themselves, okay? So that's basically what happened.
Okay.
So God had to destroy the Nephilim, because they are not natural. Angels and humans are not supposed to have sex with each other.
Okay.
And this creates a new power called the Nephilim. The problem, though, is the Nephilim are divine, and therefore, they cannot be killed. So you can get rid of their mortal bodies, but now they become demons who live underground and are in the shadows.
I'm sure some people somewhere believe this, but okay. So wait, they can't be killed, but they do drown in the flood? But they can't be killed, but the children of angels become demons because they drowned? Like, they're unkillable, and they're descendant of the divine, but not being able to breathe water for long enough? I don't know why. I'm just here for the ride. I don't know. I'm just here for the ride, man.
And guess what, guys?
What's unclear, Vosh? I don't know. Maybe I'm lacking in imagination. My apologies.
They're still here today. So these two societies, they believe the Nephilim are real, and they still control the world. The richest people in the world?
No, they don't.
Are actually Nephilim.
Okay, do you believe that?
Okay. Because they've been around for thousands of years, and therefore they're able to control the development of humanity. Okay, so they're called the Nephilim.
Are they the reason why between 1860 and 1980, American society was centered around workers? Did they approve that? Did the Rothschilds and the industrialist Nephilim allow that to happen? Was that just when we slipped out of their grasp for a little bit? Was FDR that powerful?
So that's easy to understand. But the question then is, wait a minute, why did Adam eat that fruit, and why did Jesus have to kill himself?
Dog, this is literally just Jordan Peterson again. Earlier, I was describing Jordan Peterson's that was like an affect thing, like he gives me that vibe. We're just back there again. It's the same thing!
Well, now it gets really complicated, okay? So now I need to explain to you what the secret societies believe. Okay, remember, they believe that mind leads to matter. What does that mean?
What?
Okay, let me explain what this means. Mind leads to matter. In the beginning, the true God is called the monad. Okay, the one.
What?
So just think of this as the core of the universe, the sun, the divine sun. The monad is so powerful that when he breathes, okay?
Wait, I thought we were in Christianity. There's one, it's a monotheistic religion. Are we talking about God?
He vibrates divine energy. And over millions of years, this divine energy creates new life forms. Okay? So the first life form are called the dyads. Dyads are just pairs, okay? Usually male, female, that are children of the monad. And they're able by themselves to create new universes as well, okay? So the dyads start to emanate, okay?
So wait, does this guy think the wealthy and powerful are Nephilim? What does he believe? I thought he was talking about secret societies. Is he saying that there are secret societies of people, but they're not in charge of the world? They just think the world is ruled by the Nephilim? Are they keeping themselves secret from the Nephilim?
So the entire universe is vibration. It's vibrational energy. It's the breathing of these cosmic beings. Okay?
Okay.
And over time, over millions of years, these vibrations become atoms, which then leads to matter. Okay? That's what they mean by mind leads to matter.
Okay.
Now, one of these dyads named Sophia decides, you know what? I can be just as good as the monad. What does the monad do? The monad is able to propagate by itself, by himself. He doesn't need to mate. So Sophia says, you know what? I'm going to produce something by myself. I'm going to have a child by myself to prove I am the monad, okay? Uh-huh. So she does this, and she creates a new being, okay? A new being. This is called the Demiurge. There are different names. We'll call them the Demiurge. The Demiurge is a monster, a monstrosity.
Yeah.
Because it goes against a natural order.
Yeah.
So then Sophia's like, oops, I shouldn't have done that.
No, I think this is like word for word plagiarized from the CGP Grey video on Tolkien's lore in The Lord of the Rings.
So what does she do? She abandons the monstrosity. She throws him away and hides him in a sea of clouds. So no one knows he actually exists. Okay. Even the Demiurge doesn't know he exists. The Demiurge does not know about this world, right? Therefore, he believes that he must be the one true God, capable of creating new life. So what does he create? Us. Okay? He creates the planet Earth. And then he creates Adam and Eve. Okay? That's what a monster would do, okay? Look at this history.
I feel like this is the religious text of a very depressive person. Like, somebody, like, he feels like shit, and he's like, why would a just God create me if he knew I would be born only to suffer? And then 11 pounds of high-grade opium later, you have this. Well, only a demon God could have produced me.
What kind of God would kick someone out of paradise for eating a fruit? A monster would do it. Right? What kind of God would kill a people for no particular reason? A monster would do that. Okay? What kind of God would demand that a people be loyal to that person? A monster. What kind of God would enforce his will on a people? A monster. What kind of God would say to someone, you're the only person I like, everyone else I hate? A monster would do that. Okay? So, in other words, the true secret...
What I want to know about, like, the secret societies, though. I thought the whole point of this video was that we were going to learn about the evil beliefs of the secret societies. And the only thing I've gotten so far is that... I think he said a secret society believes in the Nephilim, but isn't the Nephilim itself?
That these secret societies are trying to keep is... The God we worship today, it's the false God.
Oh.
And we are actually in a prison created by this false God.
Okay.
And that's who Jesus was. Jesus...
Like, what the fuck do you do about it at that point, though? hey, the whole universe that you know was made by an evil god, and so were all humans. Okay. Damn, that sucks. Haven't filed my taxes yet. I don't know. What do you do about that?
This was a cosmic being sent by the monad to tell us the truth about the world. And that's why he died, because the Roman Empire could not allow people to see the truth. If I told you the truth, you would know it right away. You would wake up. Therefore, the truth tellers must be killed. Okay?
Just, so that's what just tried to do that once 2,000 years ago? No other attempts?
Secret societies believe. They believe that the monad exists, and the mind of the monad is what creates the universe. And Jesus was sent to remind us that even though we're in a prison, there's still the monad in you. There's a spark in you, a divine light in you that you can activate. And if you activate it, then you will return to the monad. You will see the truth for yourself. And when you die, your soul, which is part of the monad, will want to return to the monad and can escape this world. But to activate this light, you must be a good person. You must love one another. You must reject money and materialism and grades, okay? Grades in school. You must reject competition. You must reject material wealth in order to pursue.
What does this have to do with secret societies? Here's a quick scholarly explanation for what he's talking about. Why do people assume I care about Gnosticism? I don't know why. There's like 100 people in chat are like, hey, he's talking about this. I don't fucking care. I wanted to learn about secret societies. This is all just a batshit insane, like, ChatGPT summary of a ChatGPT summary of a Wikipedia article on Christianity and Gnosticism. Who cares?
Spiritual happiness. Okay? That was the message of Jesus. Now, you can imagine that the powers that be, the Nephilim, would not like this, okay? It's a direct threat to Nephilim, who now control the prison created by the Demiurge. It's also a direct threat to the Demiurge. And that's why these secret societies have been, over the centuries, been repressed, been executed.
Okay, wait, so the secret societies are the good guys here. But in the other video, he was talking about the secret, like the Freemasons and the Illuminati. So is it, there's good and bad secret societies? I thought secret societies, by and large, were bad. Yeah, this is Assassin's Creed lore. I didn't realize. Remember, guys, Professor Jung isn't suicidal. What are you talking about? Everyone is schizophrenic except for me. Hello, I'm from USA, Florida, to be more precise. I'm 45 years old, very educated, very well-read. You can tell from his punctuation, and have a college education. I absolutely am addicted to this teacher/professor. His content has been playing nonstop for 2 weeks in my room, even if I'm not home. I'm surprised that he is in China, being that I thought they strongly censor everything, but key word there was I thought. I love the theoretical, matter-of-fact way he just says the truth about sensitive topics, especially the Gaza-Palestine conflict. Oh, God, what the fuck does he say about this? Secret History 19, Dawn of the Jews.
So we.
I'm not watching all this shit, man. An hour and 12 minutes? This video was promised to us 3,000 years ago. Remember, everyone, Professor Jiang is not suicidal no matter what happens. I heard Larry Silverstein and his entire family called in sick to watch this lecture. I stopped clipping coins to watch this. I hid in Ben Shapiro's eyebrows to watch this. Professor Jiang is single-handedly cleaning the muddy waters of modernity. Me and my 5 dancing friends stopped to watch this one. I quit my job to watch this. The Jew will always tell you what happened to him, but he'll never tell you why. Russian proverb. Curious. Fascinating stuff. Very normal comments. Well, they seem to be in proportion to the content of the channel. How evil triumphs.
Today, we are going to...
Truly, anti-Semitism is the stupid man's socialism. So far, I have not heard a single thing from this guy that sounded intelligent or well-reasoned, so... 13K likes on this one, this video, How Evil Triumphs. Damn, I can't actually believe he went all the way down the rabbit hole. Professor Jiang is a real G. He went full Red Shoe Club. Protect this man at all costs. He is deconstructing the rabbit hole in real time. Well, anyway. How draining. Ugh. He superseded Alex Jones because Alex has seen his compromise now. Yeah, and fucking Jordan Peterson is pretty much retired, so...